have four cases that are set for oral submission this afternoon. We will hear the first two and then take a brief break, and then we will hear the next two. You have as your panel today, to my right, Justice Bill Meyer, and to my left, Justice Lee Gabriel, and I'm Sue Walker. We have on our docket the first case, John Relaford versus BNSF Railway Company, and if our clerk will announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Wright Jefferson to argue for appellant, and Ms. Deborah Alsop to argue for appellee.
Counsel?
May it please the court, Your Honors, we are here today on appeal of a judgment out of Judge Walker's court, I believe the 96th District Court here in Tarrant County that was tried in August of 2009. That case was a FELA case involving a prostate cancer that arose from Mr. Relaford's employment between the early 1950s and late 1970s with the Atchison-Topeka Railroad that was subsequently merged with the purchase by BNSF. Mr. Relaford worked in a railroad tie plant in Somerville, Texas, where railroad ties were treated with a chemical solution called creosote. The issues that are presented from the trial of that case are: did the trial court commit reversible error by failing to instruct the jury on the controlling burden of proof, which is the featherweight standard of proof that is applicable to FELA cases, and did the court also commit reversible error by failing to provide the jury with the general instruction that was submitted by the appellant plaintiff in written form to the court, setting out that featherweight standard, and was it irreversible error by the court to then include in the charge the Havner standard as an instruction, the Havner standard for evaluating evaluating the reliability and admissibility of expert testimony.
Mr. Jefferson?
Yes, Your Honor.
Before we even get to the merits, though, would you please respond to the appellee's contention that this case should have been limited under 34.6C in that no proper notice of points to be relied upon was filed?
Judge, I would, in response to that, submit that I believe that the notice that was provided in the letter to the clerk requesting and limiting the portion of the record to the charge of the court provided the appellee with sufficient and adequate notice of the basis for which the appellant would be seeking review of the trial court's judgment and the verdict. During the course of the trial and during the charge conference, there was a great deal of discussion, submission of proposed questions, instructions, and objections with regard to the order of the questions as they were being submitted to the jury in the form of the charge, such that by limiting the request to the clerk for the record only of the of the jury charge and the charge conference gave the appellees adequate notice as to the issues which would be raised in the appeal. Also, although I believe the case law makes clear that it is not necessary to submit a list of items so as to effectively place the other party on notice of the limit or the limited nature of the appeal, and that they were given sufficient notice with the request to the clerk for the portion of the record that was requested.
So within that request, there wasn't anything designated as the points that you were going to raise on appeal?
None more specific, Your Honor, than the charge that was submitted as the charge of the court, and that would be limited to the questions contained in the charge and the instructions contained therein. Judge, as far as that is concerned, I think that the court, in reviewing the answers and the appellee's brief, the plaintiff's subjective belief outside of any scientific or medical evidence to support that belief with regard to the cause of his cancer is inadequate and really can't form the basis of supporting that question. Again, Your Honor, I mean, that was not based upon any scientific or medical support. It just related to his personal subjective belief. The evidence that was that came into the case in that regard, as well, was that it was not until there were some findings from testing that was done of residences in the community that there was any reasonable basis to support any subjective belief as to the causation. And so then, Your Honor, we believe, and then also as one of the issues that we briefed on appeal is the order in which the court submitted the questions to the jury. In this particular case, the court, in addition to submitting the general instruction on Havner, the court submitted its question number one to the jury and conditioned the subsequent questions upon an affirmative answer to that question, the isolated question of whether or not the proximate cause of the plaintiff's prostate cancer was exposure to arsenic. I objected to that at trial and requested that the court submit as question number one the question that he submitted as question number two, which was the proper broad form submission on negligence and proximate cause that is required by Rule 277. I had asked the court for a general instruction on the featherweight standard of causation in FELA. I requested that the court include that with the causation question. The court overruled my request. However, the court did submit the requested instruction in question number two under the negligence question. It is well settled that the burden of proof and the featherweight standard in FELA cases is a causation standard and not a negligence standard, as the court misapplied or misunderstood the application. And so in question number two, it was a broad form submission. Was the negligence, if any of those named below, approximate cause of John Relford's prostate cancer? And then that was followed by the instruction, for the purposes of this case, negligence as relates to the conduct of BNSF is a proximate cause of John Relford's prostate cancer if it played any part, however slight, in bringing about or actually causing the injury. I requested that instruction as a general instruction. Again, that was overruled by the court. The court did submit it with the broad form submission. However, as this panel will see from the record, question number one was John Relford's prostate cancer approximately caused by exposure to arsenic. As the panel is very well aware, although the trial court does have broad discretion in preparing and submitting the jury charge, it must be done so legally and correct. And the charge must be, and the issue submitted, logically, simply, fairly, correctly, and completely. And I would submit to the court that submitting the question of proximate cause as question number one is not a logical submission of the jury questions in a typical personal injury case of this type. In addition, as previously stated, the Rule 277 requires, in cases of this type, a broad form submission. And question number one is not a broad form submission. Question number two is, in fact, a broad form submission that would address both the issues of negligence and proximate cause. And by placing as question number one the proximate cause question independent and suspended on its own, was calculated and did lead to the rendition of an improper verdict. Had the questions been submitted in the order requested by plaintiff with question number two, the broad form submission, along with the instruction, the FELA instruction on proximate cause, I believe that the jury in that instance would more likely than not have found negligence on the part, negligence and proximate cause on the part of BNSF. Another point with regard to the instructions that were submitted, and we've identified it as the Havner instruction, is the instruction that contradicts and goes directly against the featherweight standard. In general instruction number four, it says, in order to prove specific causation for exposure to substances at the Somerville tie plant, plaintiff must exclude with reasonable certainty other plausible causes of his prostate cancer. That just very simply is not the standard for causation under FELA. The effect of that instruction is that the plaintiff must rule out all other possible causes, which is in effect a finding of sole proximate cause. And so that instruction is telling the jury that unless you determine that the sole proximate cause of the plaintiff's cancer is exposure to arsenic, there can be no recovery. And clearly that is not the case. FELA provides that if the employment played any role, however slight, in causing the plaintiff's injury, then the defendant can be liable. To instruct the jury otherwise is improper and calculated to lead to the rendition of an improper verdict. Also, with regard to General Instruction 3, that was objected to as well, but I would say this, that if the court had accepted the plaintiff's proposed instruction on the FELA standard and included that as number 4, that would have probably balanced off number 3, therefore giving the jury the proper instruction in the law, both as far as the state procedural law is concerned regarding Havner and the substantive law that is represented by the FELA federal statute. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deborah Alsa for BNSF Railway Company. With me is Bill Floyd from the McLeod Alexander firm and my associate, Danley Cornyn. Your Honors, this is the third case in a series of cases that have come from the Summerville Tie Plant, allegations of exposure to chemicals at the Summerville Tie Plant that allegedly caused various forms of cancer. Only 3 cases have been tried. This is the last case that was tried, and it's the last case to reach the courts of appeal. The first case is the Faust case, which two of the members of this panel know well because Justice Meyer and Justice Walker were on that panel argument. And that was a claim that PAHs and dioxins cause stomach cancer. And the jury entered a verdict for BNSF Railway. The second case was a case called Dennis Davis versus BNSF Railway. That was tried for about 9 weeks, over 2 months last summer in Burleson County. The claim was that PAHs and dioxins caused a cancer of a valve in the bile duct called the ampulla of Vater. And again, that was a defense verdict for BNSF Railway. It went to the Waco Court of Appeals and was decided on October 4th, affirming the judgment. And the cite to that, here it is, 2010 Westlaw 394-3838, or cause number 10090309CV. And again, that's at the Waco Court of Appeals. In that case, there was also a limited appeal improperly filed. The appellants appealed alleged jury misconduct. But the Waco Court of Appeals wrote a memorandum opinion on October 4th on the grounds of improperly limited the appeal and no evidence of jury misconduct. This third case, Relaford, was tried, as Mr. Jefferson said, last summer, and the claim is not about PAHs and dioxins, but that arsenic in the soil allegedly caused Mr. Relaford prostate cancer. Again, tried to a jury 10-2 verdict in favor of the railroad. This appeal, as the questions of this court have indicated so far, there are 2 dispositive procedural points before you ever even reach the issue of the instructions or the order of submission of the questions. And those points are, number 1, that a limited appeal was attempted but improperly filed, and number 2, the statute of limitations, there's 3 years to bring a claim, and it wasn't brought within that time frame. So let me turn to each of those points first briefly. Limited appeal. In order to file a limited appeal, as this court knows, you have to state your issues on appeal. And the only thing we have here is not at all a statement of issues on appeal. It's just a letter to the court reporter stating that the jury charge will be the sole issue on appeal. And
that's the extent of the detail, is just the jury charge?
Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly right. One sentence, the jury charge will be the sole issue on appeal. But that doesn't give any kind of particularity about what about the jury charge is going to be challenged on appeal. And necessarily, if you're going to challenge a jury charge, that necessarily encompasses all the evidence that went into constructing the jury charge in the first place. So I don't think you can challenge a jury charge without having a full record on appeal. But in any event, they appellant didn't follow the procedure, and therefore, the evidence is presumed to support the judgment, which then comes into play with the second point, which is that the statute of limitations bars this suit. In a FELA claim, the bringing your case within 3 years is actually an element of your cause of action rather than a defense of the statute of limitations. It works the same way, but a plaintiff has to prove that the claim was brought within 3 years of the time he or she knew or should have known of the cause of an injury. And the testimony that was in the record, and of course you don't have the testimony that was in the record, but we recited this in the clerk's record in BNSF's motion for directed verdict. You'll find it at the supplemental clerk's record 22 and 23, is that Mr. Relaford was diagnosed with prostate cancer on March the 4th, 1999, and he testified that as soon as he got his medical results, he believed that there was a connection to his work around chemicals at the Somerville Tie plant. And he did not sue for more than 3 years until November 26, 2003. So, and the jury found that in answer to question 4 in the jury charge. Because you don't have a record, you have to presume that the evidence supports that. Our directed verdict shows you that we brought that up, and for that reason, you never get to the questions of the order of the questions in the jury charge or whether those Havner specific and general causation instructions were proper or improper. But I'm happy to go there and will, because we believe that the order of submission of the questions was proper. And moreover, it's within the sound discretion of the trial court how the court wants to submit the questions. And in order to show harm from the order of submission of the questions, an appellant has to bring forward the pleadings, the evidence, and the court has to look at the charge as a whole to see whether it caused the rendition of an improper verdict. Well, you can't decide if it caused the rendition of an improper verdict if you don't have the record before you to make that determination. But again, the standard is that it's within the discretion of the trial court, and the questions have to be legally correct. Appellant here objected to the placement of question 1 and thought question 2 should have come first. But you'll see in the reporter's record at page 6 that they don't object to the language of question 1 or the substance of question 1, only that he believes that question 2, the negligence question, should have come first. So because the standard is whether the question is legally correct, it's within the discretion of the trial court where to put it. It was a legally correct question, because if there's not a connection between exposure to arsenic and prostate cancer, then there can't be negligence anyway, because you haven't shown any kind of causation, either general causation that arsenic causes prostate cancer in the general population or specific causation that it actually caused it vis-a-vis Mr. Relaford. So again, appellant had to show harm, and he can't show harm without the entire record. This is a point that this court need not reach, but Mr. Jefferson said that the burden of proof under FELA relates to the causation standard, not the negligence standard. We've cited a case in our brief called Sorrell. It's a U.S. Supreme Court case. And it's a plurality decision. But when Congress enacted FELA back in the day, it did so to make a pure comparative negligence situation so that there was no 50% bar rule. If a plaintiff was 80% negligent and a railroad was 20% negligent, the plaintiff could still recover 20%. It wouldn't be barred. The Sorrell case, the plurality says, FELA didn't change anything about causation. It didn't make some featherweight burden of causation. So that's a matter that's percolating up at the highest levels right now. And it's a peripheral point for this appeal and not before you, but I wanted to mention that it's wrong. It's not a causation standard. It's a negligence standard. The standard, so that was where the jury question one should be submitted. And then also a trial court has complete discretion in submitting instructions as long as they assist the jury and if they're legally correct. Instructions three and four were Havner-type instructions. They're almost verbatim. The specific causation about excluding other plausible causes is nearly word for word from Havner, so ergo it's legally correct, and as is the general causation, description of general causation and specific causation. The Columbia Rio Grande versus Holly case, we believe, controls the submission of those instructions, and those instructions would assist the jury in determining proximate cause, because proximate cause in a toxic tort case has certain differences than the general run-of-the-mill proximate cause. And it was a legally correct submission, and without a full record, there's no way to show harm, and there was no harm. So with that, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed in all respects. It's the presumption that the omitted portions of the record support the judgment.
I noticed that it looks like the cases that you cite on that issue have at least a little bit broader language concerning what the point on appeal is going to be. For example, you cite one of them that says the existence and liability of quick wash laundries and the damages and attorney's fees, which all those would seem to be a little bit broader than the jury charge. Is there a case that's narrower, or what's your best case on the proposition that this was not a narrow enough limitation for the statement of points?
I think the best case is CMM Grain versus Osgundas, cited in our brief, 991 Southwest 2nd 439, a general statement identifying the portion of the judgment appealed from and declaring an intention to appeal that portion of the judgment is insufficient to satisfy the narrow purpose of Rule 34.6C. And a statement that the jury charge will be the sole issue on appeal is so broad that it does not satisfy the purpose of limiting an appeal.
This is also, can I observe that being on both these panels, it's surely nice to have a little bit smaller record. In spite of whatever might not have been the appropriate presentation of the record on appeal, that Faust case was quite a stack of records.
Indeed it is.
I notice on your brief on page 15 and 16, you're talking about the question number 4. And there isn't any direct attack or any point of error raised in the
That's true.
Was this question four in the form that was requested by the appellant or by the appellee at the charge conference?
The form of the question, the limitations question, was requested by BNSF Railway in the form in which it was submitted. And there was an objection to the question, and the objection was that there was no evidence to support the answer.
But not the form of the question?
Not to the form of the question, no.
All right, thank you very much.
Sure. Thank you.
I would point out with regard to question number four that it was objected to at the charge conference as counsel stated on the basis that there was no evidence or insufficient evidence to support it. And I note on page 16 of the appellee's brief that speaks to that, and it speaks to the discovery rule, and it cites the United States versus Kubrick. And it talks about the discovery rule, and it says that for latent injuries, cause of action accrues when a claimant discovers both his injury and its underlying causes. Discovers, and the use of the word discovers is very important. Then, in the next paragraph there, Palin goes on to say that Mr. Relford, he testified that he believed at the time of his diagnosis that alleged high exposures caused his cancer. And so I think there's a distinction there between the claimant discovers both his injuries, and that's why we there was evidence submitted that it was not until the tests were done and he had retained counsel that it was discovered as far as his subjective belief that, well, I believe that that is, and that's the reason for the objection to the submission of the issue of the question that was insufficient. Evidence.
Jefferson, if I'm following you, your contention is that the evidence that was presented at trial conflicts with the answer to question number four in such a way that the evidence presented at trial would not have been sufficient to sustain a belief on the part of your client that prostate cancer commenced or that he discovered if he had it as a result of the activities at the plant on March 4th of 1999.
Yes, Judge, that he did not have a reasonable basis for making that subjective determination.
Till someone analyzed the soil and found it had arsenic and found it could have caused his prostate.
Correct, Your Honor. And then that then provided a reasonable basis then for having a belief that, in fact, the cancer was related. I mean, otherwise, any layperson, well, I mean, that's when I thought it. Well, I mean, that would not be sufficient enough to support a verdict in his favor that was causation. Right. And likewise, it should not be able to.
And point out to me, please, sir, where in the appellant's brief or even the appellant's reply brief that those
Judge, I think in our reply we might have attempted to raise it, but I'm not totally certain. And so to that extent, I would like to include that into the record today. One last thing I would like to say in my last few seconds. The Faust case and the Davis case are distinguishable from the Relford case because those cases were not FELA cases. The instruction that was given with regard to ruling out all other causes conflicts directly with the federal statute. And as the court is very well aware, In those instances with FELA cases, it is federal substantive law that controls and not state substantive law. And so that instruction that says you've got to rule out, and we had some questions from the jury after this, the fact that you give an instruction that says you have to rule out all other causes when, in fact, the standard is if the employment played any role, however slight, to give that one instruction but not to give the other instruction did not provide the jury with the information that they needed in order to be able to effectively answer the questions. In addition, by placing the proximate cause question first and disregarding Rule 277's requirement of a broad form submission, that was error. And that created and led to the rendition of an improper verdict. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Jefferson, Ms. Alsop, your case is submitted. We appreciate your arguments before the court today, and you are excused to go about your business.
Thank you, Your Honor.